Stations from the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, the water coming out of the mine shaft still contains levels of uranium and arsenic that is about 30 times the amount considered safe by the Environmental Protection Agency for drinking water. And there is always the possibility that the pond holding all that water could spring a leak. Amber Raimondo says the risk of an accident is theoretical with regulators until it actually happens. The ore extracted from Pinyon Plain Mine would be trucked to Energy Fuels' White Mesa Mill, a processing facility in southeastern Utah, adjacent to the Uta Mountain community and near Burr's Ears National Monument. As the only operational uranium mill in the United States, White Mesa's processing business is likely to significantly increase with more domestic uranium production. The 40-year-old mill also produces uranium by extracting it from industrial waste and stores leftover radioactive material on site. Like the Havasupai, the Uta Mountain Uta people are worried their drinking water could be contaminated by the mill, and they're afraid to gather traditional plants in the area or even let their children play outside when the air smells bad. In August of 2021, the tribe passed a resolution declaring that White Mesa Mill should be closed in order to protect the health of the community. But that request has not been acted upon by local government officials in Utah. Manuel Hart, the Uta Mountain Uta tribal chairman, asks, "How can we make sure tribal members can get clean drinking water when radioactive waste is just a few miles away?"
General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kataib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad Airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. Defense Secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action, this is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. Secretary of Defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. Secretary of Defense, we would consider that an act of war, and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown Kerman, after his burial had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities. However, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is, again, very funny, because in the mainstream media, they were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ain al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ain al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who is lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It was the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work. And the president had an entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It was like, we had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War Powers Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, the strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in United States national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States. Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the special rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the U.N. Charter and that, quote, the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful. Article 2.4 of the U.N. Charter forbids the use of force by one U.N. member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the U.S. were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a U.S. drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of The East is a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance. But whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed sorts of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy. And that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect, the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded over the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know. It was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions. On that front, what was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mahdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real... There are these two men played historic roles, yes, but ultimately they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems have been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions of it's trying to establish its, like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came their mercenaries for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, their supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy. And we undercut the value of Abu Muhandis, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But like both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'abi in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran. And one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist. But Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic, and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani. This is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasim, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasim. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored, the fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what the religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. You cannot have a terrorist defending Christians. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlets want to present. So there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. It was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. This is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS, and in a lot of cases they actually helped ISIS. And the country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that was Qasem Soleimani. So that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi?
You know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that the Israelis were involved. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination, and overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember just a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics. Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, the project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right, together they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
According to fresh data from the New York State's comptroller, the average bonus dished out to Wall Street employees jumped 20% to a record $257,500 in 2021, as big banks reported huge profits despite widespread havoc caused by the coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Jaw-dropping Wall Street bonuses have soared 1,743% since 1985. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis estimates that if the federal minimum wage had grown at the same rate as Wall Street bonuses over the past 3.5 decades, it would currently be $61.75 an hour instead of $7.25. According to fresh data from the New York State Comptroller, the average bonus dished out to Wall Street employees jumped 20% to a record $257,500 in 2021, as big banks reported huge profits despite widespread havoc caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Last year's average Wall Street bonus was the highest since 2006, prior to the Great Recession. The Comptroller Office points out that while the securities industry comprises just 5% of private sector employment in New York City, it makes up 1/5 of total private sector wages. Taking the new figures into account, Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies notes in a report that the average Wall Street bonus has soared by 1,743% since 1985. By contrast, typical American workers lost earnings power in 2021, Anderson writes, noting that high inflation has eroded the modest wage gains seen by ordinary people. Adding, average weekly earnings for all U.S. private sector employees rose by only 2% between January 2021 and January 2022. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Anderson adds, these jaw-dropping numbers are just the latest evidence of unequal sacrifice under the pandemic. While ordinary workers are struggling with rising costs for basic essentials, Wall Street bankers have seen their bonuses rise further into the stratosphere. Anderson argues that Wall Street bonuses have been soaring in recent years, partly because Section 956 of Dodd-Frank Act, a financial reform measure enacted in the wake of 2008 crash, has never been implemented. Anderson writes, powerful Wall Street lobbyists have succeeded in blocking Section 956, which prohibits large financial institutions from awarding pay packages that encourage inappropriate risks. Regulators were supposed to implement this new rule within 9 months of the law's passage, but have dragged their feet.
despite widespread recognition that these bonuses encouraged the high-risk behaviors that led to the 2008 financial crisis, costing millions of Americans their homes and liveliness. In contrast to the Wall Street lobbyist, advocates for the working poor have seen their efforts to raise the federal minimum wage and secure other important worker benefits stalled in Congress, she continues, adding, due to Washington's inaction, millions of essential workers continue to earn poverty wages, while the reckless bonus culture is alive and well on Wall Street.
Çömen. Yani...
Bazaar. The world's first electric elevator was built by a German inventor nearly 150 years ago, marking the beginning of the world's history of the electric elevator industry. But the idea of using lifting mechanisms dates back to more than 10,000 years ago. The first known lifters were in fact wells. Elevators and escalators have had a big impact on modern architecture and design. Through the innovation of these two travel systems, we are able to effortlessly move through multiple levels quickly. This technology has changed the way we travel through the buildings we encounter every day. Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will be talking about Iran's elevator and escalator market. We wanted to see how this industry is doing nationally and internationally. But before we get to that, we wanted to see just how much work goes into making these items and who the major players in the domestic field are. Plus, we will uncover this sector's contributions to related trades and the economy as a whole. So stay with us and let's get started. To familiarize ourselves with how elevators are made, we visited the production facilities of Behran Asambar in the industrial town of Parand near Tehran. With over 30 years of experience, it specializes in making elevators, escalators, and industrial lifts. It also manufactures lift gearboxes and gearless motor drives as well as other important parts. This company has made a name for itself through products that create harmony between a practical and aesthetic design, which also offers safe and quiet rides for passengers. This company has implemented hundreds of projects, many of them you probably have already heard of. Some of these are Imam Khomeini International Airport, Tehran Subway System, Iran's Parliament, and the list goes on and on. From its humble beginnings, this company has expanded its manufacturing over the years and now has a production hall with an area of over 110,000 square meters. In addition to manufacturing full lift and escalator packages, this company provides its 14,000 customers of various types with parts and components. Moreover, it is a trusted representative and agent of some known foreign brands as well. Among its many services, this company offers consultations, installation, and after-sales services to its customers. Roughly 1,200 people are employed at this company. Many of them are experts in designing products that seemingly integrate with any project's unique environment.
Here's a fun fact about elevators. Each day, elevators move around some 330 million passengers around the world. In other words, all elevators combined together carry the equivalent of the Earth's entire population every 3 days. This also means elevators and escalators are more frequently used than other forms of transportation. That is why their demand remains high, both nationally and internationally.
While this company is broadly known inside Iran, it is internationally active as well. It has official representative offices in Iraq, Syria, and Armenia, as well as permanent international offices in countries including Oman, UAE, Germany, and Turkey. But that's not all. This company has implemented hundreds of large projects in several countries, including Azerbaijan and other neighboring nations. The quality control department at this business holds the pulse of the company. Here, new products are designed and existing products are improved on. One of the most important activities in this department is quality control. The output of all stages of production undergoes stringent quality controls that begin with checking the raw material. This includes repeated safety checks to ensure nothing goes wrong with the final product. It also has a test tower with necessary knowledge-based mechanisms for testing its various packages and parts. This company received its operation license from the Ministry of Industry. Additionally, it has received certificates from the National Standard Bureau as well as other international standardization organizations. Among its future goals, this knowledge-based company is planning on expanding its product portfolio as well as its export market. Over the years, this company has faced numerous challenges to enjoy its many achievements. One such obstacle has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. It has viewed this issue as an opportunity to strengthen its business and fill a market void.
Probably the biggest customer of the escalator and elevator industry is the construction sector. Demand for this industry is largely based on trends in the construction sector and downstream activity. Companies such as the one we just mentioned have indigenized productions of lift technology and reduced dependency on imports while saving the country billions.
The electric elevator industry in Iran is roughly 80 years old and began when the first oil refinery was built in the southern city of Abadan. And now, this sector is thriving. The Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industry says the country has the capacity for producing and commissioning 80,000 elevators annually. But only 25,000 units are currently produced each year due to the stagnation of the construction industry. The highest level of elevator production and installation in the country was recorded in 2014. This was mainly due to the boom in the construction of Meh housing units. The project was a large-scale construction program that was launched in 2007 to provide 2 million low-income Iranians with housing units. During the heyday of this massive nationwide project, nearly 75,000 new elevators were installed. Such productions pushed Iran to be ranked as third in the world in terms of elevator demand after the United States and China. That's all based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries.
There are plenty of construction projects being carried out all across West Asia. The government has targeted neighboring countries to increase its elevator market reach. Some of these countries include Armenia, Iraq, and Syria. Parallel to this, it is also supporting ways to strengthen the infrastructure for increased production of elevators and escalators.
Towards this goal, the government is encouraging collaborations between research institutions and other knowledge-based companies in this field. By increasing technical know-how through scientific research, companies can stay up-to-date and relevant in the highly competitive market. Right now, the domestic demand for elevator and escalator sales and installation stands at roughly 50,000 per year.
Presently, there are a total number of 750,000 operating elevators in the country, which move around 250 million people daily. That's based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries. On another note, Tehran's subway system is the biggest consumer of escalators in the country. However, many of the lifts and escalators in the system need to be upgraded or overhauled entirely. Currently, about 1,200 escalators are active in various subway stations across the capital. While Iran is a major producer of elevators, it still needs to further develop its escalator productions as most of its technology is still being imported. All things considered, there is so much investment potential in this thriving sector, which promises a bright future. All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
If you live in a tall building and not on the first floor, you're likely to use the products we're about to introduce. The products that grant equal access to people who are on different levels and have varying degrees of physical ability. So let's get right in and learn about elevator parts.
In the manufacturing of every elevator, various factors should be considered, such as the height of the building, the number of the people traveling to each floor, and expected periods of high usage. All elevators, however, consist of similar parts. It's said that necessity is the mother of invention. Not having elevators back when even the tallest buildings didn't have more than a few floors was already a concern. But with the rise of modern buildings, it quickly became a necessity.
One reason we dare use elevators is that we don't worry we're risking our lives in doing so, even if the elevator happens to fall. And that is largely thanks to two elevator parts, the governor and the progressive safety gear, also known as the parachute.
The governor manufactured by this company was the very first one in the country to meet the required standards. The first specialized elevator parts manufactured by this company was the lift door opening magnet, and they're now well underway to manufacture the rest of the required parts.
Iron and cast iron sheets make up some 60% of the materials used here. And this CNC press break machine is programmed to shape and prepare these sheets for the desired application.
Some 90% of what's required for manufacturing is made right here in the country. The basics of elevator manufacturing haven't changed much for decades. What has changed, however, is the systems that control their speed and safety.
Here, the press machine punches and cuts the iron parts to prepare them for the later stages of welding and painting.
Thanks to their after-sales services and lifetime guarantee on their already high-quality products, the company's market share in the country is now at 70%. But the managers aim to go far beyond the national market and increase their reach. They plan to set up their manufacturing in other countries such as Syria.
Like the people living on different floors of a tall building, different countries do not enjoy the same access to resources. It's the use of ingenuity in industries, however, that can elevate any country, no matter where it started from.
Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, the oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil. This time, we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique. Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Saze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services. The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and offland. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more. Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services. One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality. here's a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world.
Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from the removal of sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed.
As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas. And Iran makes a large amount of both.
Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity.
We are almost out of time for this program, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends regarding this industry and its related trades. A knowledge-based company has managed to design and engineer one of the vital components used in elevators that were previously imported.
It is a gearless elevator motor. This item was designed by an electrical engineering professor at Yazd University, who is also the head of a knowledge-based company. The product has already received its commercialization license, and the company is set to produce over 500 of these motors annually.
Another product indigenized recently in the elevator industry was manufactured by a major company in the steel industry in Isfahan province.
Presently, this company manufactures elevator guide rails among its other products. Project managers say this is the highest value added to any of the products made at its facilities. Before its mass production, this item was imported with a hefty price tag attached. The developers say productions have saved elevator and escalator industry participants about $200 million in foreign exchange.
These days, research and development centers are facilitating the rise of productivity in various industries. A new product that has been created recently is a super-accurate welding machine. This machine uses laser technology, which offers precise cutting and engraving to its user. The high density of the laser light can heat the surface to the boiling point in a matter of milliseconds so that it completes the welding task quicker. It also leaves a clean finish compared to other traditional welding machines. And with that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bozor, thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time for another edition of Bozor.